Moncrief on News Talk.
First, though, Niamh Ní Donal is a senior clinical psychologist who has a professional and personal stake in how legal proceedings for rape and sexual assault cases are conducted. During a trial, if the survivor has gone for therapy, those counselling notes can be used in any subsequent court case. Professionally, she's aware of this happening, and as a survivor of sexual violence, it was a factor in the court case she was involved in. Niamh, good afternoon.
Afternoon, thanks for having me.
I suppose after a rape or a sexual assault, there's kind of like two parts. There's the legal part, and then there's the healing part, in a sense, that involves therapy. And those two things shouldn't be connected to each other. Would you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think first of all, for lots of people, there is no legal part. Either they don't report to the guards or they do and nothing happens. So I think they're a really important cohort here.
Mm.
But I think you're right that the therapeutic and healing part really should be distinct and separate from a legal process.
Yeah, I suppose by which I mean there might be a legal process. Somebody might even be successfully prosecuted for that. That won't necessarily make the person who's been raped feel better.
Absolutely not. And certainly in my experience, it didn't necessarily help. And I think, you know, I didn't enter into the legal system, and I don't think we should, with an expectation that it heals us. But I think, you know, numerous of us have said that actually it has caused a lot of damage as opposed to helping. And that's not okay. But I think what's in front of us right now is probably a lot more grave than that.
Yeah. And people then who present to a therapist with a view to kind of helping themselves heal, that seems to be kind of an arc where it's not necessarily here's the problem, let's fix it, that they have to kind of understand it to a degree and understand their own feelings about it.
Yeah, and that's a huge process. Like, I mean, even to sometimes understand our own emotions in a given day where there's nothing complex going on is hard. Trying to understand your emotions in the context of trauma, and particularly something like sexual violence, is incredibly complex. It takes an awful lot for someone to, I suppose, take the courage. And it shouldn't require courage. It should be that it's natural and easy for someone to seek support. But indeed, I think it takes an awful lot for people to feel that they can, that they should, that they're worthy or that they deserve support. And I think that's something that as clinicians, we work really, really hard to create. We consider everything about how we sit. You know, indeed, I'm not sitting in a therapeutic stance right now. My legs are crossed.
Yeah.
If I were in a therapeutic session with you, Sean, I'd be sitting a lot more kind of relaxed. We think about the words that we use, our tone of voice. We wonder about the questions that we ask. And I suppose the key bit about therapy really is that we're curious. We're not looking for facts. I'm not on a fact-finding mission with the person that's in front of me in terms of evidence.
Mm.
But I am in a state of curiosity with them and for them in terms of trying to understand not necessarily what's happened to them, but what's happening for them inside them. And all with a view to trying to find a way to make life a little bit easier.
Yeah. And can that start from a point of view where, and you could really understand how that might be the case, somebody comes to you and they don't want to really face up to the enormity of what's happened to them and their feelings about it. So at the start, it might be, it's not a big deal, but I thought I'd come to you kind of thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Very, very regularly, say it maybe at an intake or a first meeting. You might have a chat with someone about different things that have happened in their life. What brings them to therapy? Who are they? Their strengths as well as the things that might be difficult for them. And of course, I suppose, as working in mental health, you're always holding where trauma might be. Because trauma really is the mainstay of our work in mental health in one way or another. So I don't always expect that someone's going to tell me in the first instance. And I certainly wouldn't put pressure on them to do so. My point is always go as far as you're willing to go. We'll meet again if you want to, and we can go further then.
Mm.
So I'm always leaving a space for something to be disclosed, but I'm never expecting that it's easy, even in that situation, to do so.
Yeah. Now, but what you're describing, though, is an arc. There's a whole story that probably takes place within the totality of the therapy. When those notes can be produced in court, they're not necessarily telling that whole story.
Well, I suppose we're becoming very, very cautious in terms of what we take down in our notes. I'd argue that we shouldn't have to do that. We should be able to record what we feel is necessary and important. Because don't forget, like, a lot can be said in 50 minutes. And of course, sometimes you'll have sessions where nothing is said. And I can recall a couple of sessions where nothing was said for 50 minutes and it was about building up to being able to speak. But we see many people in a day. And it's important that we're able to document what someone has said. Now, of course, in my own note-keeping, I wouldn't document my curiosities. And I'm going to hope that I hold on to them and remember them. But if someone has told us something or there's something there that we kind of want to return to, maybe they've just said a particular word or particular phrase, you want to be able to hold on to that in some way. The note-keeping, we can't do that there. But my fear here is that we're all quite scared now that there is literally someone listening at the door. We can't have that.
Yeah. But does it happen that a defence barrister will go, oh, look, but you said this in your first two sessions and use that against someone?
Unfortunately, it seems so. Like, I can speak from my own personal experience that my therapy notes were requested by the defence. It was really distressing. I pushed back. I requested them in the meantime and spoke with my therapist at the time around even just the process of reading those notes back.
Oh, God.
Like, it's incredibly difficult to read someone else's thoughts on how you presented when really, really distressed. And even though you might totally agree and you might know it was true, that's not nice to read back on. Then to consider that there's a whole host of people who you're probably not even going to be told these are the exact people who are going to read it. That's incredibly distressing. And then I suppose my question is, like, for what purpose? Like, you know, when people look for these notes, do they have a set of guidelines within which they can mine for information? Can they just cherry pick? Well, on this day you said this thing. You know, I can't conceive of any other situation where notes like this, like, you know, medical records would be requested without there being some kind of guidelines as to how they're used. And I don't understand why we, as the therapists or clinicians working with the person, aren't actually invited to maybe write a report or to speak to what happened.
Well, that's interesting, because if the physical part of it, a doctor is brought in to explain that.
Really?
For obvious reasons.
Yeah. And for me, there is an arrogance to just taking those notes. And that as a therapist or as a victim or a survivor, you have absolutely no way to explain what was meant by what is being interpreted. And really interestingly, again, if I reflect back to my own experience, so the therapy notes were requested, I pushed back a fair bit, and my memory somehow in the end, and I don't know if I was ever given a reason why, the notes weren't used. So that was good. But conversely, I remember saying, well, I have really significant diagnoses of, post-traumatic stress disorder. Surely you would want proof that I have that and I can get you proof. Would you like it? And I was told, no, we don't need that. That's fine. So that's kind of interesting in terms of, you know, because my understanding is that the point here is that it's the right to a fair trial. So in my experience, the notes were requested, but when I offered evidence as to impact, I was told that's not necessary.
Mm.
That doesn't add up.
Yeah. Also, it completely undermines the work of a psychologist then. I mean, if somebody presents, then do you have to tell them at the start, well, if I take any notes, they might be seen by X, Y, and Z?
We do that to an extent already. So there's very much a kind of an initial talk that I would have when first meeting with a client, and it's explaining around the kind of limits of confidentiality. So I'll always start off by saying everything we talk about here in this room is confidential, but there are kind of limitations to that, and that's under children's first. So if I think that a child is at risk of harm, anything like that, or if I think, say, particularly with young people, but indeed adults, if they're at risk to harming themselves or someone else, I have to pass that on. So that's always a conversation that I have at the beginning, because if you have that then and you have to return to it, it's a lot easier to explain that when you've spoken about it once rather than retrospectively. I'm not sure how I feel. I mean, because I think, firstly, I know even having that conversation with children's first, and we need to have it and it's important and the legislation is there and we are duty bound. But I'm always aware that I'm possibly already shutting something down. And I have to, that's my duty. But I'm always just conscious that it might take us a while maybe to get to something that this person might want to speak about. I'm kind of loath to now say, by the way, these notes might be taken. There's no legislation there. There's no guidance, but it could happen. Like, my duty to my clients is to create safety.
Yeah.
And I actually feel that that's being completely compromised right now with absolutely no guidance, legislation, no discussion from the state or the DPP with any of us as clinicians or psychologists.
And are you finding in your own practice and among your colleagues that then people are very careful about what they might commit to paper?
Yeah, we are. And that's fine. And we can do that. But I think it's more, why are we having to be so, why are we having to think that there's someone at the door? Why are we worried that someone is just going to come in and take those notes? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's shutting something down when we work really hard to try and to create that kind of safety. And if we're talking about, you know, state or state-funded services, we're already on our knees in terms of a lack of resources. We're already fighting over what rooms we can take a client in because there aren't enough therapy rooms. We're already trying to figure out ways, how do I do this additional training? How do I get to do this trauma training when there's actually no budget for it within the service? I'll just go pay and do it myself. So we're under these constraints within services. You have people who are incredibly dedicated, who will do anything. And yet here we are in a situation where we had hope less than a year ago that this was going to be changed. And now for some reason, without any explanation, it doesn't seem like it is. In fact, it looks like it's going the other way.
Niamh Donnell is a chartered senior clinical psychologist. Niamh, thanks very much.
Thanks, Mel.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.